So you've helped a lot of people, obviously, and that's your mission. It's just right. If you were going to give someone that wanted to really create a movement and help as many people as possible, what would be the first step that you would begin with?
Make it non-negotiable. So anything that I'm committed to, I'm going to make it non-negotiable, which means every day for a minimum amount of time, I'm going to ask how I can be of service in person, on the phone, via email or social media or tradition. I'm going to make sure 7 days a week. It's non-negotiable because that's the only way that it happens. Certain things will happen better if you make it what I call hybrid negotiable, which is, okay, once a month, I'm like my wife and I, on the third Monday of every month, we feed the homeless. So that's a hybrid non-negotiable that we do no matter what. If I'm there, she's there, whoever. And that's not going to get the same impact of me doing something every single day. And then also knowing what it really means to help someone. So a lot of times, you know, and there's a charity, forget the name, my phone's not here. There's like a system of people when you help people. Like if you help them one time, what it does to them, the second time, the third time, all the way to entitlement. So understanding what it means to help someone. Because a lot of times, especially as a parent, we think we're helping our kids and we're weakening them. And so I think understanding how we help people and being able to, you know, let them know that's not going to help you. And so in my faith is you have your own God, I have my own God. My faith is that my God's bigger than me. But there's this faith that just because I don't understand it or evidence is contrary, that I feel like I'm being punished. How many times do you think your kids feel like they're being punished, but you know you're helping them? So how many times do you think in your life that your father is punishing you, but you're being helped? And so I think two things, you have to make it non-negotiable, but also understand what help is. Because it's not rainbows and sugar and everything else that a lot of people think helping is. For me, like, I think it is help. Some guy's on the street, and I don't know who he is, and I'm never going to see him again, right? I'm going to help that person by giving them money. But very few people, that's how I help.
Yeah.
And I know that's a short-term help, but I also know it'll bring some ease, even if they're buying drugs or alcohol with it. Right? I'm in a position to put them at ease. And if they're in that position, it's different. I'm not going to give my kid money all the time just because they ask or beg me for it. Perfect.
Anyway. So is there another way to say what you just said about non-negotiable, that it's about being totally committed or all in or having no plan B?
So I don't think it's no plan B. I don't. Because I think if we don't... I believe the problem and solution exists as one. There's a lapse of time for human beings to figure it out. But I do think you need to be fully committed to and know what's important to you. So if you want to help people, like, and that's truly your mission, then you have to have non-negotiable time every day to doing that intentionally. And intention's not just doing it. It's saying it. It's believing it, thinking it, and feeling it every day. So I actually am very pragmatic about intention, like with my scheduled and non-scheduled time, paid for, unpaid for time, and even my sleep. I'm very intentional because I know where I think I want to be or better according to the circumstances of the day. And then I make a plan, here's what I'm going to do today, say today, think today, feel today, and believe today. And when new circumstances arise, time, emotion, and value changes, I now utilize prioritization mechanisms to reevaluate, and that creates the plan B from plan A. But I think you're wasting time if it's like you're already behind the eight ball, in my opinion, when circumstances are what creates a lack of statistical success. And we can't control circumstances. The only circumstance we can control is 24 hours a day. So if we stay committed to non-circumstantial behavior, we actually take circumstances out of the equation. So when you start doing plan Bs, we now are doubling down on circumstances because we're trying to say, well, if this happens, then I'm going to do this. to me, that seems less statistically successful than saying, here's my plan today in alignment with where I think I want to be after I get my non-negotiable behaviors down. And as circumstances arise, I'm going to learn from them. And plan A is going to be plan A1 plus, then plan 2A plus. So it's an evolution. I think the same thing about people don't take inventories of their skills, their knowledge, and their desire. And they're always looking to, and I got this from athletes and military people, they all want to, what, pivot or transition. Well, you're already putting yourself at a disadvantage when you, as an athlete and as a military person, you've already developed extraordinary skills, knowledge, and desires. Now you're just transitioning into something else. That doesn't make sense. For me, it's like, okay, take inventory and align it with what's doing well, what's stable, or you think is doing well, and don't transition, but grow into or expand your military career, your professional athlete career into, not transition, expand it into technology or sales, or because there's so many skills, knowledge, and desires, as you know, even being a second or third string college football player, that you use to be successful.
Yeah, I was with my sister who works at, she's the dean of the College of Arts and Sciences at Marquette. Just this past weekend, she went to my son's high school graduation. And we were talking about circumstances that you walk into where there's a potential for some type of downside, or you decide to do something, and that there's this habit of people to catastrophize. In other words, like,
yeah,
you start like envisioning, like, what's the worst thing, and it's going to be bad, and you start thinking it could be so bad, and then you get all wrapped around the axle. And she had a really profound statement, I thought, where she was like, really, if you just break it down, what's the worst thing that could possibly happen? Like, it's probably the world will continue to, you know, revolve around the sun.
Right.
And I think it's a related topic that I really thought was a powerful statement she made.
Yeah, I think within the context of even Napoleon Hill, if I could get people to focus in on what they want or what they already are instead of what's missing, what they don't have, or what other people want, right? This energy gap between I am and this is what I want people to think I am, especially for young people.
Oh, yeah.
And I have a very positive family and household and culture, but I still catch, like, my 15-year-old when we're playing golf, especially, he'll take, I hope this doesn't happen, right? We're wishing for what we don't want. In fact, golf is so interesting for me. Think about this as a football player or any other sport. How many times you walk up to your best drive? So now you're sitting right in front of the green, and while you're walking up to your ball, after you just hit your best drive, say to yourself, man, I hope I don't chunk this.
Right.
Like, after, say you hit a guy on a fly route, 70 yards and you're on the 2-yard line, how many quarterbacks come to the huddle and go, hope we don't fumble?
Yeah.
What do they say? Let's fucking get this in the, right? Why is that? And so, you know, when I'm teaching my son mindset, I don't teach him golf. I hire pros to do that. I'm not good enough. But I teach him mindset. I'll stop him and I'm like, why are you wishing for what you don't want? Because it is powerful when you wish for what you do want or better. Right, I'm always saying yet, or better, or more than, power over a billion people. I'm never limiting myself. Question? Oh, sure. All right, you get it. All right, cool. All right, we're gonna overlap. So just, I love to teach, especially people that wanna build brands, build communities, you're asking. So there's so many mechanisms that people waste. Right, like this, I love doing Clubhouse. I'll get 100 people that will listen into this, and they'll be a bigger part of the community. They'll learn something. They'll email, text, DM me, show up to the next city meetup, where all I'm doing is putting an earpiece in and holding a phone. Yeah. I used to do Sanford and Son. You guys old enough to know Sanford and Son? The original platform, I go live on every platform with multiple arms and phones in my laptop. So I would do Friday training, IG phone, TikTok phone, LinkedIn, really? You couldn't go live on at the time,
right?
And then StreamYard, it was awesome.
Wow, that's very cool. That's awesome. So I just want to ask, like, you've taken your most painful and fearsome events and turned it into gratitude. And how is it, because I look at you and your community and how busy your schedule really is, how is it you keep it a habit to keep gratitude in your life and whatnot on a daily basis? I mean, it's got to be a priority.
How do I keep gratitude in my life when there's so much struggle that me and everyone else in life have? I always say don't waste the struggle. The way we don't waste struggle is to make it a objective of struggle to find the solution in that problem. Struggle's a problem. Solutions are one with your problem. Human nature and human beings and human experience, we need a lapse of time, most of all the time, to find the actual solution in the problem. And that lapse of time, we define as struggle. Not for me, I find it as a search for gratitude. I also, which really helps me, when something's simple and powerful, I double down on it. Like, I keep saying this to people all the time. Simple things to do are simple not to do. And so what happens is there's these simple things that are super impactful and powerful, like saying thank you, or looking at the glass half full, or finding the light, the love, and the lessons that have the most impact on everything. So I've practiced, here's my reaction to fear, here's a struggle. I know what struggle is. It is relative. And that's why I love Viktor Frankl, Man's Search for Meaning. When I realized that, when I was studying time and relativity from Einstein and Frankl and, you know, Max Planck, and because I study physics, quantum physics, what I started realizing is all this science that I was studying had nothing to do with what I was really searching for. What I was searching for was what Viktor Frankl set the mark for. I have a nice iconic story about losing so much money, so it resonates with people. But what makes that book, in Man's Search for Meaning, is that very few people on earth could even imagine the struggle. Like, a lot of people can't imagine the struggle I went through, but it's nothing compared to Viktor Frankl. And so when you have this litmus test and you're able to say, man, let's just be honest. It's relativity means meaning. And so if I change relativity by changing the meaning I give something, and so when I started looking at the failures, mistakes, setbacks, defining moments, historical relevances, all these things in my past, and change the meaning of it to align with where I wanted to be, instead of making it interfere with where I wanted to be, limiting me. It'll only be the meaning of your past that limits your what? Self-image. And you'll never overachieve your own self-image. So when I feel like, oh, I don't want to do that, or it happens a lot if you've ever been married or in a really intimate relationship. How many times are we fucking up our relationship because of the meaning of the past? We're limiting how much we are loved or give love because of all the love past. And all you gotta do is change the meaning of it. And so when we think of linear time, infinite time, and relativity, if we think about it as, how am I giving the meaning to my 24 hours a day, which is that incremental segment of life, that's all you get. You shouldn't even, the other stuff just give meaning to. So I give meaning to my past in alignment with the meaning I want in my future, and I only deal with 24 hours of activity. And I know I'm guaranteed that increment every day of my life, except for the last day I'll be cheated. But it makes, it somehow brings a majesty of calmness that you know what to do, and you start getting to this respect. Jimmy Friedling from Branded Hospitality that I just interviewed, he was talking about the same shift I went through. It's like, yeah, the outcomes are just the meaning I give those, but it's really, can I enjoy what I don't like or love, or can I enjoy what other people don't like or love? And the only way you can enjoy what you don't like or love is to give it meaning for the sake of whatever. You sat on the bench, probably had to do a lot of work when you're in college football. Show up, lift, films, just like sometimes more. I have found, being a second string player in college, I had to do more work than the starters.
Less glamorous.
Way less glamorous. But that struggle, I gave meaning to and put it into the meaning of my future. Instead of, I could have been pro if I was just taller. How many short guys say that? And I always say, what the fuck are you talking about? You know any professional football players are 5'7", 8", 9"? Tons. Good thing Austin Eckler didn't say that, or Marshall Faulk, or Barry Sanders, right? Daryl Green. Awesome.
So you talked about aligning your past and where you want to go in the future. What are your thoughts on legacy and purpose and the role it plays in your life? I heard one famous boxer saying, you know, he could give a flying bleep about, you know, about legacy. We kind of like heard of this popular boxer before, but just wondering what are your thoughts on legacy and purpose and role?
Yeah, that's a great question. So a lot of people live their human experience for legacy, which a lot of people determine what will people think of me when I'm gone. Anybody ever walk a college campus? Do you know how many guys built those buildings and their names are all over those buildings? I think of the undergrad, the graduate schools I went to, all the colleges I've spoken at. I have no idea on that. So for me, legacy to me is understanding the infinite energy and infinite time. So in the aspect of everything, all-knowing, everything information, everything energy, my behaviors are my legacy. Because it's my behaviors that will create energy that is infinite in its nature. So the only reminder, remembrance, and recollection to me is the one to the infinite, not other people reminding, recollecting, or remembering me. Because look, even when you're alive, your legacy are snapshots of your past. And if you take the people that you're the closest with, you know, what is your legacy to your little brother? I guarantee my little brother does not think about me in a way that I want the normal idea of legacy. Why? Because I used to pit him down and flirt my spit up and be competitive with him and, right, all this stupid stuff. And he has that snapshot of me. And so for me, my legacy is my behavior, and this idea of being kind to your future self, to me, is my legacy. People ask me all the time, what are you going to put on your tombstone? But I'm only going to put one word, kind. Because no one's going to remember the date I died or the date I was born, or, you know, let alone 10 years, 20 years, or 100 years after I'm gone. Do you know when Ben Franklin was born? We barely know Ben Franklin. And so when we're living legacy, we're living energy, we're living behavior, and we're creating abundance or kindness, I believe the soul is our legacy, and however that manifests itself, materializes itself, either in a quantum oneness or in some kind of reincarnation or whatever you believe in, it doesn't matter to me. So I'm trying to live my legacy instead of creating a legacy. Does that make sense?
I'm a firm believer that legacy is past, present, and future.
Yeah.
And it's all connected.
You could have answered it for us. That's much easier. Much better answer. Hello.
Hi.
You have a question for me? Not yet? Okay, good. All righty. Where did my daughter go? Anybody else have a question? Dan? Yeah, Paul? Thanks. You're right, talking to this.
You mentioned the iconic story about your struggle earlier. Can you give some context or some inspiration on how you were able to get out of that?
Yeah, that's good.
What were some of the first things you did?
That's the question I would ask. Either how'd you lose all your money, or what'd you do when you lost all your money? I think that's where the real lessons for me were, is how did this happen? How am I accountable? So when I went back to answer the first question you did ask of how did I lose all that money, what I look at is in the past, finding one, what did I do to be responsible? What am I supposed to learn from it? What did I do to attract it to myself? What am I supposed to learn? And how did I participate in the perception, and what am I supposed to learn? So when I went back and said, how am I responsible for it? I wasn't paying attention. I was attracting all the wrong people and wrong ideas, and I was participating in a perception that I was in control. And so those were the three lessons that I look backwards and say, oh yeah, this is what I'm supposed to learn. You're either humble or you're about to be, right? You're not in control, and you're responsible to be intentional about where you want to be or better, not where other people want you to be. Because that's mainly my biggest problem was surrounding myself with the wrong people and wrong ideas, buying shit I didn't need to impress people I didn't like, and doing things all the time to please everybody else. And it cost me. Now, how did I get out of it? I think for me, one, I set my expectations that I knew it was going to take time to get me to where I wanted to be or better. Doesn't mean it was going to take me time to make money. I also convinced myself, giving meaning to my past, I always made money. I literally said to myself when I lost everything, took me 9 months to be a millionaire. I knew no one. I was 100 grand in debt. I didn't ever have a real job. I went to law school and undergrad. And like, in what world am I not going to make money? That wasn't even a thought for me. So for me, it wasn't about the money. It was, things happen very slowly, then all of a sudden, can I be very consistent and intentional about all these things, the mistakes of the past? So I practiced humility. I built my faith. I practiced being consistent, having I practiced firing people from my life. I came up with this criteria evaluation. I still use it. How relative are you? What association do we have? And how much am I being fed either by you bleeding or feeding me? Now that's evolved, but at first it was just fire people that bled me. And then I realized that people that bleed you can feed you. So like my mom, when she was dying, nothing bled me more, but it was so, still is, fed me so much. My kids, I got three daughters and a son, they bleed me, but they feed me more because of the bleeding. So I took this on and continued to improve intentionally. And yes, I made money very quickly because I was humble. I went to the people that had the most money and said, man, how can I provide value to you? You know, and I brokered deals, did anything I could to make money, but that's not what the comeback was about for me. It was being mission, not commission-based. Commissions follow. Speaking to that one.
Yeah.
So on that note, like with the becoming a millionaire in 9 months, you know, Jim Rohn says, if you give somebody $1 million, best become a millionaire. So you already had that mindset installed, even though you ran into some problems and whatnot. What gave you that mindset, and how has it helped to give you a foundation, even though you went through all the struggle?
Yeah, great question. So what gave me the millionaire mindset? For the sake of what? When I was young, I wanted to be rich for the sake of my mom. Buying a house, car. Anytime she was unhappy, was fine. And that's what drove me. And I think it drives a bunch of people. And when I started making all that money, I lost for the sake of what? For the sake of being cool, for the sake of people thinking I was rich, for the sake of whatever. That failed me. And so understanding that I stopped saying, like I used to say, I'll be happy when I make $1 million or $100 million. Now I even say now, when I make over 1 billion people happy, and when I make over $1 billion from making over 1 billion people happy, I'll be able to change the world. So for the sake of changing the world, I am gonna empower over 1 billion people to be happy. I am gonna make over $1 billion for the sake of changing the world. And therefore, everything else doesn't really matter.
So there's a lot of things that you can spend your time on in any given day. Everybody that's in this conversation, we're all involved in a lot of things because our ambition is
abundant.
More than just, yeah, it's abundant. But to me, the key is to decide at any given time what to focus on to the detriment of everything else. Like, what's the one thing that by doing that one thing, it's going to make everything else easier or unnecessary? I'd just be curious to get your take on, like,
oh, yeah.
How do you decide?
Yeah, that's easy. So we talked about having non-negotiable behavior. I'm a math guy. It's obvious to me what will have the most impact on your life. The number one priority should be is your sleep. Like, what else do you take a third of your life doing? And when you think of sleeping, like, I think every day of being in the Hall of Fame of sleep, being the best sleeper in the world, because I recover better and access information and energy better than anyone I know because I sleep. Now, because I have more energy and more information and recover better, now I'm more healthy, better family, better finance, better faith, better relativity. See how sleep actually does all those things for you. You're a health guy. But I just, as a math person, said, well, if I'm going to prioritize one thing, I might as well prioritize the one thing that I spend the most time doing and has the most impact on everything else in my life. And that's where sleep, hey, buddy, that's where sleep became the most important thing, which then led to health, next, my health, which then led to my family, which then led to finance, faith, relativity, and the study of time.
Do naps count in that sleep?
Yeah, so I have a sleep coach, and so, you know, there's very...